Previously on Popping Collars.
I maybe have told this story on Popping Collars before, and it's totally anecdotal, but when I was in seminary, I took like an intercession term class about sexual misconduct, preventing sexual misconduct in churches and reporting and stuff like that. And the instructor in that course was not a professor at CDSP. So don't worry, CDSP, this was not one of yours. She pulled me aside. I was very young in seminary. She pulled me aside after class one day and told me that when I got ordained, I would have to cut my hair and stop wearing makeup. She actually said that.
What?
So that I wouldn't be sexually harassed, right?
Wow.
So, I mean, it's weird on so many levels. That's bizarre, right? That's totally weird.
Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. I'm your host. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida. With me is my sometimes co-host, Kyle Goodman from Statesville, North Carolina. Hello, Kyle.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
Good. And we have a couple of special guests. First is Lauren Scheck from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks for having me again.
And Patrick Thompson from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
This is episode 38 of the 1,148th ranked podcast in the iTunes spirituality category, and our topic today is Game of Thrones. So, best I can do for a plot synopsis. So, while a civil war for control of the kingdoms of the fictional world of Westeros brews, the children of the former rulers of the land position themselves for power, and meanwhile, a forgotten, mysterious force awakens in the north and begins to make their way south, bringing the cold winds of winter with them. And this is one of those sweeping fantasy works that has evolved over many years in a series of books written by George R. R. Martin, and has over the last few years been adapted for television as an HBO series. And I guess since we don't really know where the story is ultimately going to go, I'm curious, do you think that this is a morality tale? Is it a tragedy? Is it a hero's journey? What kind of story do you think we're dealing with here? Patrick, you want to kick us off?
I believe that Martin is pushing us to examine a kind of broader context to a lot of what's happened in Western society and culture over especially kind of Middle Ages time. I mean, there's so many parallels to England. It even looks like England. And I think that in the end, we're going to see that nothing is going to get tied up and it's not going to be a comedy or a tragedy. And it's just going to be kind of a brief snippet of history that's going to get resolved in a way that probably no one's going to be happy with, judging by George R. R. Martin's state of affairs so far.
No, that's totally true. The way it's been going so far with the characters, it's like whenever a character starts to give you hope, that character is gone. Yeah, it's hard to know what the ultimate end is, because if this were Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, we would know what the end is. We would just have to figure out what the journey is to get there. With this, anybody could end up on that throne. Daenerys could end up on the throne. Peter Baelish could end up on the throne. And the whole world could be in ruins. There's just no telling. Which makes me wonder, like, what's the point of that, then, as a storytelling device? And there's ultimately no point to it all.
I don't know if I'd say there's no point to it, but I think the struggle is we haven't quite seen who the main character is. It seems like every time you might think you have the main character, it's about Ned Stark. No, it's not. It's about Robb Stark. No, it's not. And now, you know, we see little snippets of maybe 5 or 6 main characters, for each one totally different. Sort of a coming of age, coming to her own power with Daenerys and learning about herself. But then you have others that are more playing with the power, not really thinking of it as how do I make the world better, but how do I make myself better? And then the Boltons that are just horrible people who like to torture for fun. So I find it hard to label it one type of story without knowing who is the story actually about.
What do you think, Kyle?
Well, just to sort of dovetail into that, I think the story really is more about characters than it is anything else. I mean, I think you're right. I think Patrick's right that where this is going, we don't know, because really the interesting thing happening, you know, is always with what's happening in the characters' lives. And, you know, the storytelling vehicle in the novels has always been to tell sort of a limited point of view from the different characters. And so you follow the whole story from the point of view characters in each chapter. And I think the show is in some ways like that, too. And for me, I think I compared a lot to The Walking Dead in the sense that, you know, long ago I stopped caring about zombies on that show. And it's always been about, you know, these characters being put in impossible situations and the decisions that they make, good or bad, right or wrong, both sort of this the looming inevitability of death and yet still, you know, those characters persevere and push through and endure. And it's the same on Game of Thrones. I mean, the characters, most of the characters at this point that we've invested ourselves in have endured much more than, you know, any human being could ever think about, you know, coming to grips with. And even characters that at the very beginning, that first season, seemed so incredibly weak and helpless, like Sansa, you know, now is out there, you know, making her way, you know, through an impossibly brutal and terrible situation. And who knows where she's going to end up. But it seems like at this point she's being set up to be, you know, a powerful hero, a character that no one could stand in season one because she was so whiny and inept. And now we're seeing the evolution of that character into someone that you can actually root for.
I think that concept of the redemption arc of each character is dangerous for Sansa, certainly, in the world of Westeros, but I also do agree that it's what the watchers of the show and the readers crave. And so what's so interesting to me about, you watch the show and you talked about like the inevitability of death looming over the horizon to the characters, that's not necessarily true. While they're living in their day-to-day lives, as watchers and readers of the show, we certainly believe that everyone is inevitably going to die if we love them as a character. And so there's such an intense fear from us as the viewers that our favorites are going to die at any given moment that we crave that redemption. We crave even the worst of our characters. I mean, we're all feeling for Cersei now. We see these characters who we just hated at one point. Now we want them to be okay and be good people because we need someone to do something that makes us happy in the show.
Am I the only one that's not feeling sympathetic towards her? Like, I felt like she really deserved her whole shame walk because she's been pretty awful to everyone.
I don't know if, I mean, it's sort of how you parse the word sympathy. You know, I don't necessarily think you're wrong that she hasn't gotten exactly what she's deserved. But, you know, when you walk with, you know, the torture she's received, I mean, the walk of shame is one thing, but knowing what she went through to get there, that she has finally, you know, ended that long walk of terror through that religious trial and public shaming, and she's finally back in the Red Keep and everything's right and she's about to squash her enemies, and she sees that boat coming as a ray of hope. The best scene, I thought, actually, in this whole first episode of the season, just the look on her face when she realizes that she's not going to see her daughter, that her daughter is dead, and that Jaime was sailing in to bring... Oh, that to me was just the high point of the whole episode, to see, you know, just how crestfallen she is. And that's not sympathy necessarily, but, you know, you're with that character in that grief. That switch.
More like empathy.
Right, right. Fair enough.
Okay.
Now, I always try to look for information from titles, and A Game of Thrones was the one that kind of threw me, because the others kind of make sense. Like, you know, when all the kings start fighting each other, Clash of Kings makes sense, and, you know, Storm of Swords, all of that stuff, Dance with Dragons, all of that stuff makes sense. But the Game of Thrones part, you know, even though it's referenced, you know, what I ultimately came away from that book thinking was that all of the elders in this world are passing away, are dying, and it's the children that are taking over. And they see these politics, these political games, as just that. They're just games. I think of early on, well, when Arya and Sansa and Joffrey are involved in that incident with the butcher's boy, right? And Joffrey is trying to show off for Sansa, and Arya ends up getting in a fight with Joffrey, and they have to kill one of the direwolves as a result of what started as a game and then ultimately had these horrible consequences. And it just makes me think of, like, all the times that it references back to these great heroes that existed, these Ned Starks and these
Sir Arthur,
Robert,
the Arthur Dayne, the Sword of the Morning.
Sure, Rhaegar, you know, Targaryen. Like, it references all these amazing people, but the people that we experience are just regular people, you know? They're not these mythological kind of creatures. And it just kind of feels like, instead of something heavy that we're working with, we're just kind of playing a game and moving pieces around on a board and seeing what ultimately ends up happening.
I think you're right. There's a sense, I think, with every single one of the characters that we're left with, that they were really not prepared for the role that they're currently playing by their forebears. I mean, even someone like, well, I mean, you had Robb Stark, but, you know, he you're sort of investing everything in him by the time he's killed at the Red Wedding. And the rest of the Stark children, you can sort of take or leave, right? I mean, they sort of play their, initially they play their trope. You know, you have your prim and proper, you know, lady, you have your tomboy, you know, you have the child who's just too young really to even know what's going on, and then you have the one who, you know, is physically disabled for, you know, basically the entirety of the story. You know, they're not necessarily prepared for the roles that they are having to inhabit at this point. And it's true for the Lannisters and really all the characters. There was no one there to teach Daenerys, you know, how to be queen. She's had to learn that herself the hard way over and over again. She didn't have her Targaryen parents to prepare her for that.
Now she had a crappy brother to prepare her.
Creepy brother.
crappy, creepy brother. No, that's right. And I think that's something that comes through in the books, is that they're younger. These are younger characters in the books. These are children, for the most part, in the books, or just very young teenagers. And, of course, HBO can't really do that for a television series. So you kind of get, like, these two kind of disjointed worlds, because at least I feel like when I'm watching the show, I have to, you know, if I'm trying to figure out if this is envisioning the books, then I need to subtract about 10 years from each of these actors. And that's basically where it is that George Martin's head is at anyway.
Although you get a little bit of it, I mean, especially with Tommen now being the king, and last season with he and Margaery and getting married and then having to consummate the marriage and him just wanting to play with his cat. And so you still, I mean, I still think, and I think HBO is pushing more towards that to make it a little more uncomfortable for everyone, which is good. Although I guess this season we're going towards the other direction with very old people. But I think that concept, I agree, of the kids and the game is very interesting, and that some people cheat in the game, Peter Baelish being the best example, I think. Or even, I mean, Cersei and Jaime and killing off Robert Baratheon and all of that. I mean, there's some people that are trying to play the game honorably and not cheat. I think of playing a board game with my family and my children, and my number one goal is to make sure my children don't cheat at Monopoly or something and take extra money out of the bank. But does that teach them to win the game, or does that teach them to be poor beheaded Starks down the road?
Right.
It's also, we see in the Game of Thrones that being cunning is maybe the best thing. A wit and a fast talker. Like, how in the world is Tyrion still alive? There's no reason that he should be there. Or, I can't think of his name, the one who talks to the birds.
Varys.
Yeah. Like, he's another one that's like a smooth talker and can sort of get himself out of a situation by saying, let me connect you better. Let me help you cheat. and we'll get that person back. That really makes it game-like. Not that we would want, if we're playing Monopoly, we don't want that, but...
But I do like that idea of cunning, though. Like, because there's nothing wrong with being cunning, necessarily. I mean, hell, the whole book of Genesis wouldn't exist if it weren't for cunning people that populate the patriarchs. The whole state of Israel is named after probably the most cunning character from the Bible, in Jacob, right? I mean, like, it's an admirable trait. It's just, how are you using it? Are you using it to advance your own power, or are you using it on behalf of your chosen people?
There's a sense, I think, that in his rise to power and his, you know, very deft political maneuvering of the situation, the wildlings of the wall, that Jon Snow has been cunning. I mean, maybe he wasn't cunning enough not to be stabbed by his own men, but aside from that, he's done a pretty good job of making an impossible situation work up there at the wall.
Oh, we got a resurrection story coming, I think.
Oh, there's no doubt.
I'm wondering about the belief system in this world and what you guys make of it. So we've got the old gods in the north, right, that are generally kind of nature-oriented, specifically through trees and stuff like that. And then we have the seven gods, the new gods, that are basically honorifics that are worshipped, but kind of just used like a God bless America kind of way. And then we have the Lord of Light, the God of Fire, which feels very Yahweh-ish in a lot of ways. And so I'm just wondering, like, what do you guys think about the religious world that Martin has laid out?
That's really how I see the religion of the seven, as really, I think, ultimately, in the religious experience and the supernatural happenings in the show, it's really just an empty institutional religion. I don't think there's been really any instance that I can recall in any of the story where there was anything meaningful that happened in the faith of the seven. It's really, I think, just an institution. And, you know, we've seen sort of the Inquisition aspect of that organized religion, you know, in King's Landing. And really, it's sort of those other two, the religion of the Lord of Light and the older, you know, tribal religion of the old gods, you know, in the north, that has really led to something meaningful happening in the sort of the overall spiritual struggle of the show.
I find it interesting that a lot of the characters, they just sort of throw it in there, like, I swear this by the old gods and the new. And you wonder, are you even listening to what you're saying? Or does it, as you said, Greg, become like ending a speech with God bless America?
Right.
Sure, you want God to bless America, but are you actually praying? Or is it just the right thing to say?
It's like people that get to the end of prayers and they're like, oh, I got to say something. Like, in Jesus' name, I guess. That sounds good.
Right. Like, right. So I swear to you by the old gods and the new gods, and then I'll never, ever talk about them again, or, like, actually think about how any of my actions might affect my relationship with those gods, or that any of these things could be happening to me because of how these old gods or new gods feel.
I mean, do we get a sense that there are any gods at work apart from
the Lord of Light?
We've had the Lord of Light visions given to Melisandre, which may or may not be true now. It looks like, coming off of the first episode of this season, that Melisandre is having a crisis of faith in her Lord of Light.
But
and is, like, trying to see the truth.
She's having a crisis of faith, but I don't know if that would mean that her experiences were not true.
I looked into this before the podcast, and there's a expecting this topic, and there's a neat little quote by George R. R. Martin that says, ask about which one is the true religion. And he said, and I quote, I'm a little weary of the word true, whether any of these religions are more true than others. I mean, look at the analog to our real world. We have many religions too. Are some of them more true than others? And I don't think any gods are likely to be showing up in Westeros. So, interesting, end quote. So, interestingly, I think that one of the things you see in this world is you have to acknowledge the fact that there's magic in the world. And it, whether we see belief systems around things that people can't explain. which has always been the case, that we can't explain that. We'll call it a God act. But we know that Bran is up there learning how to maybe talk through some trees, right? So if that's the case, then the people in the north, they believed that it wasn't necessarily some kid who had lost his legs falling off a wall, but was actually the trees themselves speaking to them and watching them, because they have faces that were carved and eyes that they could, that we, and they knew the trees could see them, which is true or in this world. So they're honoring those gods or worshiping those gods to them, which are this magical device of the tree being able to watch them.
I mean, is that what we're trying to do in our world, is explain the unexplainable? Like, I mean, is that the work that we're doing with people?
I think it's about the people as much as in this mythology as it is about the individual characters we've become invested in. You know, I think those are where the questions lie. You know, it's not, you know, are we going to get a well-articulated worldview and a completely nicely tied up package of this is how the supernatural works in this world. Instead, it's just how the people encounter it and wrestle with it. And isn't that really the same thing that we do in our world? I think there's something about the, for lack of a better term, religion or spirituality of this particular series that's more true than it would be in, say, your Harry Potter or your Lord of the Rings, where everything is just sort of neatly understood and wrapped up. There are characters who get it, and they're leading the heroes to get it, and by the end we sort of understand how things work, and it's all done. I think we've talked about it already a little bit, but we're never going to fully understand, I don't think, the answers to those questions by the end of the series, and I think it would be worse off if we did. I'm sure we're going to have folks who are very faithful to all three of those systems of belief who are going to play a role in the final conflict, whatever that looks like. I mean, we're certainly shaping up to see that with the Lord of Light and with Bran and the old gods. You know, folks who are faithful to all are going to find something strengthening and meaningful about that as they, you know, face the ultimate enemy.
It feels like from this first episode of this newest season, there's this great scene, Margaery Tyrell in the tower with the sparrow, with the high... Let's see, the High Sparrow? Is that his title? Anyway, the priest, right, of the Seven. That's like, that's got them basically in the Tower of England, trying to get her to confess her sins, which she has many sins that she probably would be good to confess, but they're using it in a very power-specific, like, politicized way. But, you know, he sits down with her and he says, if you have sin, what you need to do is confess. And she says, I have nothing to confess. And he says, oh, so you're perfect then. You have no sins. You're wholly without sin. And she says, well, that's not right either. And I think that, like, the thing about that moment was that was probably the most sinister part of the episode for me. But it was using language that I would probably use in my regular life, you know, like this idea that, yeah, confession is good, you should confess, but like what that meant to the character that he was conveying that message to had so much sort of terror and power built up in it. And it just, I mean, you know, it just reminds me that in this world, in the world of Game of Thrones, religion is as much a weapon as anything else. And certainly we saw that play out last season, and it's, you know, starting to play out again this season. I'm trying to think, like, at some point, every candidate for president has to say something about their belief system, right? I mean, even Bernie Sanders had to say something about what he believed religiously in some debate, I'm sure.
Well, he met with the Pope, so... Regardless of his own personal faith, he made a move to sort of welcome others to his cause.
You would get the sense that an agnostic would have no chance of running for president, really, and being considered a serious candidate.
If you can't say God bless America, could we trust you?
I think that you're absolutely right that you have to play lip service in our, you know, political process to some sort of system of belief. The going joke in some of my circles is that the most Christian candidate this year seems to be the Jew. But that's it's an indictment of the process, and it's an indictment of the way that religion has been distorted, particularly in my context in the South, how it's become so just tied up in a particular political viewpoint.
I can just hear all the candidates when swearing by the old gods and the new that they didn't do whatever they're being accused of.
Absolutely.
Now the color of her hair. Now the color of her eyes. Every memory of that winter is a curse upon my nights.
So we can move on to our 5-minute coffee hour segment. This is where I'll throw out a topic and we'll discuss it unfiltered in a way that we would as if we were at our churches holding a little styrofoam cup of Maxwell House and putting down a little Danish with topics of the day. But before we get to that, I want to give you guys a chance to plug whatever it is that you want to plug, church website, blog, Twitter feed, anything like that. So, Patrick, do you have anything that you would like to plug for our listeners?
Not that I can think of at the moment.
Okay.
I like
Lauren, do you have a website, blog, anything that you want to plug?
Just keep up with me on Twitter at Reverend Lauren. It's mainly pictures, which makes it fun.
Kyle, website, blog, Twitter feed?
Sure, you can check out my church, ConcordPresChurch.com. You can find me on Facebook, and if you prefer me on Twitter, you'll just be getting what I post on Facebook that Twitter conveniently reposts. So, check me out at either of those places.
Usually I open up the 5-minute coffee hour to whoever has something that they're dying to talk about, but I have something that I'm dying to talk about, so I'm going to take over the time. Lemonade came on Saturday. So this was the Beyonce video album premiere of her latest album. So it premiered on HBO. It's like an extended video. I can't explain it. It was like an hour long sort of art piece. And it was incredible. Like, you know, there was all this talk this past week about when Prince passed away of, like, you know, oh my gosh, this was an artist that pushed the boundaries and allowed other artists to do really creative things. And I thought that, like, the proof of that was this Lemonade, this video album that came out on Saturday. Did any of you guys see it?
See Lemonade. I did see the Saturday Night Live retrospective that featured the Prince show with co-host Beyonce.
So what was the Prince thing on Saturday Night Live, Kyle?
Oh, Saturday Night Live did a whole hour and a half of old musical performances by Prince, and then old Fred Armisen and Maya Rudolph sketches. It was one they were doing back in their day where, it was just a poking fun a little bit at Prince, and familiar Saturday Night Live trope. They have their own talk show, and Prince has his show, and Beyonce is his co-host because, you know, they were easy impressions.
And are you old enough to know Prince music, Lauren?
Yes, I'm old enough to know Prince music, mainly because I was introduced to Prince and Madonna and Cyndi Lauper through my favorite uncle. There was many a day of jumping on a bed and listening to their music. So,
no kidding. Prince, Madonna, and Cyndi Lauper?
Yeah, and Michael Jackson.
Yeah, that I could see. Cyndi Lauper seems a little confusing in that mix somehow.
Although Prince wrote a lot of her music.
Did he really?
Yep.
What's that one that I love that's from Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion? Oh, my gosh.
I know which one you're talking about, but I can't.
Oh, it's the one that they dance to. Time After Time.
Mm-hmm.
Time After Time. Did he write that one? Because that one's great.
I don't know, but I do. I did hear in a – I was watching kind of a retrospective about him on the news the other night. And they said that he had written a lot of music for her and some for Madonna and for a few other people. One of the things that about Prince that really interested me, I thought, from that was that he was – I didn't realize he's a Jehovah's Witness. But that in that he did a lot of charitable acts that he wasn't allowed to talk about. And so a lot of what he did with his own money was give it away, which I thought was quite intriguing. To various charities that he took no credit for.
And to bring this all full circle, I don't know if you've all seen on Facebook, it's been a lot of people have posted memes saying that it seems like 2016 has been written by George R.R. Martin because all of these favorite beloved celebrities and icons are dying in his fashion of as soon as you like someone, they're gone.
All right, so let me wrap up the show. Okay, so you can find us on Twitter at Poppin' Collars. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/poppin'collars. And you can find our show each and every time at poppin'collarspodcast.com. We are also featured on episcopalcafe.com. We love episcopalcafe.com. We know you will as well. Check them out for all your Episcopal news and beyond. We're so grateful that they feature our show each and every time. And also, if you get our show through an app, Stitcher, iTunes, SoundCloud, any of those places, feel free to subscribe, rate, and review our show. That way we'll move up in the rankings and more people will be able to see us. So please take the time to do that. And so with that, thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Patrick, for coming on the show this time. Keep those collars popped. We'll see you next time.